Welcome to another episode of the VetMed Mind Behind the Journey, where we dive deep into the stories of those who shape the veterinary profession with their dedication, innovation, and passion. Today, we're thrilled to have Dr. Kelly Cairns with us, a visionary leader and a truly wonderful human being. Dr. Cairns currently serves as Vice President of Medical Excellence and Education for the 400-plus hospitals in the Thrive Pet Healthcare family. Today, Dr. Cairns shares not just the story of her impressive career, but also the personal journey that got her to where she is today. It's a conversation about growth, success, and following your joy. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kelly Cairns to the VetMed Mind.
Thank you so much, you guys. I so appreciate the opportunity and everything you guys are doing.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you living right now? What are you doing right now? So we can just start there.
I'm Kelly Cairns. I'm a veterinarian. It's just like the terrier, Cairns. And I'm sitting in Naperville, Illinois, which is a amazingly wonderful suburb of Western Chicago. And what am I doing right now? I'm doing a lot of things right now. I'm supporting the people at Thrive Pet Healthcare. So I'm the VP of Medical Excellence and Education for Thrive. I do a lot of other things on the side to support folks in the veterinary profession.
One of the reasons, Kelly, I wanted to have you on the show was my journey. I serendipitously, fortuitously, but certainly circuitously, looked, I used all three of those words, circuitously got into veterinary medicine, and it wasn't necessarily a plan. And I always tell people, like, some of the things I'm shocked by. And one of the things that I've been most pleasantly surprised by in veterinary medicine is like the characters / intellectually gifted people that I run across, that I know that if I had had any other profession, maybe it would happen. But we're kind of, some professions are laced with brilliance and idiosyncrasy. You know, veterinary medicine is sprinkled with brilliance and idiosyncrasy. And you're one of those people that falls into, I think, both of those categories. Because when I met you, I was like, okay, obviously you take notice. If you don't know Dr. Cairns, you know, she's kind of a fashion statement. She certainly carries herself with confidence. She's verbose. She's opinionated, but in a gentle way. But beyond that, like, this is the trip. Right. You are like a human being and you have like 17 years of postgraduate education or something ridiculous like that. Folks, do you know what it takes to become a veterinary specialist and a boarded specialist at that? Like, sometimes, in my opinion, the educational process of becoming a boarded anything, and then if you had fellowships on top of that, almost sucks the soul out of you, you know, because it's so much to have to consume. So, but you, your soul has not been sucked dry, or you had an abundance of extra soul or something. So let's kind of touch on that. First of all, like, you're a veterinary internal medicine doctor. So about that journey in and of itself, like, how did you get there? And then have you always been this, what I would call exuberant, energetic, I will grab life if life doesn't grab me kind of person? There, that's a lot. How about that?
That's a lot. Yeah. So let me start with that, the second piece first. So yeah, so I kind of don't have a moderate decibel as a human. So I'm either on or off. I am one end or the other end of the bell curve in everything. Like, my switch is on, my switch is off. And that's just how I've been hardwired as a person, like even as a child, it's on or it's off. And so what I've come to realize is that that's actually kind of a secret superpower. But it has to be leveraged and harnessed in the right way, at the right times, in the right circumstances, or it literally becomes my Achilles heel, because I'm a lot. I'm a lot for a lot of people, right? So that's part of my chronic self-work. And I like to think I'm getting better, like, progress, not perfection. But, like, seriously, jokes aside, is part of my work. Like, when I see my therapist every week, part of it is literally, how can I make sure that I'm using this as a superpower and not literally as a weakness? In terms of it's all or nothing. So, I mean, I'll pause there. You know, I'd love to tell you about my journey into veterinary medicine, but yeah, that's me.
Well, and we'll get back to the journey in veterinary medicine. Let's stay on the first bullet, because one of the hallmarks of specialists, obviously, or veterinarians in general, is this very EQ, we call it the competency of achievement orientation, but just being, you're very focused on it. I don't know if I would call it achieving, but I would call it accomplishing. It seems like. And so that drive on or off, is that a survival technique, or And what does it mean to be off? Like, what does that mean? Like, you just lay around like a slug in Australia that doesn't do anything?
What I mean by on or off is that I bring 500% intensity to everything I do. I can't just cash it in or like half do. And even when I think about like my energy states, you know, I'm either up and going and doing a bunch of stuff, or I really am just, Kelly's taking a rest right now, if that makes sense, in terms of on or off.
Well, and that's so interesting. Like, you know, in an industry where we have a tendency to go. So you're saying that you always had this sort of quality of either on or off. I guess I'm curious if now in your career, as far as like wellness, preventing burnout, right? Because I can imagine it going 500% every single day as a practitioner working in a hospital could lead to an intense amount of burnout. So was that always there then as that safety net for you that you were able to really just turn off when you needed to?
I think I've gotten better at that in terms of setting boundaries to make sure that you have enough energy in your tank to keep going and to do things for other people. But, you know, Sean, you had asked and mentioned earlier about the whole kind of achievement orientation as a profession. And I will say like 500%, a lot of introspection on this over the decades. I feel like I was always hardwired to achieve and get accolades academically. And because I think when I look back at like, you know, kind of why, it's because that's when I got praise, you know, kind of like if anyone only ever says to you, you're pretty, you start to feel self-worth and validation in your physical appearance. For me, it was the academic accolades. My mom and my dad and everyone in both sides of the family, highly achieving, incredibly intelligent, postgraduate, doctoral educated, you know, and I don't think I felt a lot of pressure coming from them to achieve, for it was always intrinsic and self-motivated, but there was definitely a lot of validation when I did have the achievement. And so I was for a really long time just hardwired to, I only applied to one college. I did it through acceptance, where if you apply to one college early, and then, you know, they say yes to you, then you don't apply during the normal cycle. And what college was that? Well, I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian, but MDs seemed to get more esteem. And so I was going to go to the number one med school in the country. So I applied to Johns Hopkins, got in, and then I had to do it in 3 years instead of four, because that felt better to me. Let me do it quicker and get good grades, because that would be achieving. Everything in my life was hardwired to academic accolade, do it the best, be the best. And I don't feel that way anymore. I've released all of that. Now my self-worth is really based in, do I feel really good about the impact I had on others in my space? And that fills my cup.
It's just fascinating to me that we can jump through all these hoops and still at the end of it is, I just want to feel good. You know,
yeah. I'm curious, Kelly, like, was there a situation, a job change, an experience that caused that shift? Like, were you maybe put into a new role where you were exposed to more feeling work than academic work? Or like, was there, or did it just happen naturally over time that you became more aware of the feeling side of what you were doing?
You know, I think time and just constant trying to work on being a better person tomorrow than you are today. But I also think there were two specific, like pivotal, like things that helped. I'll start with the second in terms of temporally, because the second or more recent was COVID. My husband and I, we do like to be prepared. So like, you know, we do have some food at home. We have water at home. We could be constantly prepping for the zombie apocalypse.
This woman, folks, she carries 16 days worth of food just in
this
one
bag. This is true. I've eaten with Sean. He knows this. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that really kind of was like, if you thought there was terra firma on this planet, you were like, what's happening, right? And so, you know, that I think all humans had a lot of introspection about what am I doing with my life and what really matters, right? So I think that was maybe the more recent pivotal moment. But then going back in time, the first was actually it started when I joined Thrive, which at the time, part of Thrive was Pathway, which was the when people choose to join and sell their practice. And it legitimately was, I'm not kidding you, the first time I listened to you talk, Sean, at the first
first conference and I was like, what is this situation? So I'd read this book called Traction about business. And then I went to this first VGP conference and I heard Sean McVay talk and was like, what is this? This is literally life changing. And that became truly like everything I learned to be a better in team member at Pathway. I pulled through and tried to absorb and do as much work as possible, just as me as a human, in my personal life. So I would say, honestly, I've never said this to you, Sean, and this isn't a plant, but I'm having the epiphany in this real-time moment. It was actually meeting you and trying to learn as much as of what you were trying to teach, which was really meant to be applied to the veterinary profession. But I think that the central tenets are transcendent of that. And they're really just humanity stuff.
Veterinary medicine is just an excuse to talk about that. Because the transformation is that, no matter what profession, no matter what marriage, no matter what, you know, whatever, when you start to get real with yourself and go through that stuff. Wow. That's cool. Makes me feel good. What would be your message to other equally driven and gifted people that are blocked, that aren't open to the message of feelings, that aren't open to the message of achievement isn't just conquering, if you will? Because there's a lot of doctor folk that I think are forced to listen to me and they might get the message, but they wouldn't generally tune in. But they're going to see you and they're going to tune in.
Yeah. And I guess the first thing I would say is, dude, you know, whatever brings you joy and is your jam, that's awesome. Like there's probably some folks out there that truly, it really does fill their cup to have an achievement and to get, you know, that degree or to get that, you know, whatever it might be academically. And I totally respect that. And so, you know, if that really does bring you joy, that's great. You know, I think what I try to do when I work with folks in the veterinary profession and try to support them and be a servant leader is I always talk about like passion-driven purpose is like, we're all in this because we're drawn toward it, right? It's passion. It's our passion-driven purpose to be in this profession. But I think we need to think about what parts of it bring us joy and what are the parts that are challenging and or frustrating that don't bring us joy and really think about how we can control the controllable to fix those parts. Because I actually think there's more in our control than we oftentimes, when it gets busy, ascribe to being in our sphere of influence.
For people that just the journey, I've always been so fascinated by the journey of specialists, like, because it's such a part of the pun, it's such a myopic place to land on the vocational field. I still, to this day, I mean, I work with people in veterinary medicine that don't understand the degree, in particular, American veterinarians go to. Because you can go to Canada, Europe, Australia, and they have quote unquote specialists, but they went to school for 7 to 9 years postgraduate. I don't think you're going to approach what you did. So tell us about when did you know you wanted to love animals and be a veterinarian and then your veterinary academic career, like, you know, college on through and how you arrived at, so it'd be like an IMBD, but how you arrived at Thrive in this position. Yeah,
sure. And I love telling this story because I love to talk about my failures in the journey, just as a message to everyone to not give up. So, you know, as I mentioned before, right, is I was always like highly academically achieving and I always knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. You know, I think I wanted to be a doctor until I was maybe about 8 to 10 years old. And then I was like, I think I want to do animals, but the same thing, right? Not people. I wanted to be a physician. Then about 10, it pivoted to animals for I think all the reasons that a lot of us are drawn to want to be veterinarians. But again, I mentioned before, I was still very achieving and I was like, well, I want to go to the school that's known to be the best for training physicians. Like it feels like just pure science, right? So I got the early acceptance to Johns Hopkins and I did that for my undergraduate. And then, but then my very first, and it like shocked me to my core, I just assumed I was a Colorado resident. And so I graduated Boulder High. I just assumed I would get in, you know, back in 1990, that I would just get into vet school because like I'd never been denied anything academically. And, you know, I just, at that time, I didn't get in. Okay. So I didn't get into CSU and I was devastated. So like I talked to the dean or the dean of admissions, right? I was like, well, what could I do? Like, you know, what parts of my application, you know, could I improve? And what I was told was that essentially it's kind of at this point luck, right? They didn't say luck, but it's like there was nothing about my application that was ostensibly any different than the average accepted applicant. But they also have like many, 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 many people applying than they have spots for. And I'm literally just, you know, I started college when I was 17. I'm 20 basically when I'm graduating. And so what I really should have done, and I realized, you know, decades later, I should have just applied again and I would have probably gotten in like the second year. But I was like, I'm not going to do that. I got denied. So I applied to the deadline for Royal Veterinary College or RVC in London was later. So I applied there and I got in. So I went there and then promptly had a panic attack because it's a different system. I wasn't prepared to be alone abroad. I left my cat at home. I had a boyfriend in the States. So I dropped out after 2 days and lived in London and had a great party for 3 months because we got our refund on everything other than the dorm. So I was the crazy girl who lived in the dorm but didn't attend the school. So then I eventually realized I have to go back to the States. And so I'd already been teching, you know, for a long time. So I kept teching. And then I said, well, I don't really know what I want to do. I'm kind of having a quarter life crisis. You know I want to be a veterinarian. So I thought that I might want to go to graduate school for a PhD. So I did that for a hot nanosecond and realized that wasn't for me either. So I moved back to Colorado and ran a lab at the med school in Denver, an immunology lab for 5 years and took classes at a community college and kind of just matured. And then 5 years later, I said, I'm going to do this vet school thing again. So I applied to CSU. I did not get in again. So this time I was level-headed, took another class at the community college and applied again and pivoted my application essay to be a little more authentically me. And I got it. So it took me 3 times to get into vet school. So now I'm 26. By the time I hit vet school, it was a job. And so it was very easy for me to treat it as a job, you know, be businesslike about it, get a 4.0, graduate summa cum laude, and treat it like a job. So I knew I wanted to be an internist, though, from the very first day. The way my brain is hardwired, I'm very analytical. I like to put a puzzle together. You know, back in the day, I don't know if the SATs are like this anymore, the GREs, but they used to have the analytics section. It was like the math section, the verbal section, and the analytics section.
Wow. So here's the deal. Sorry to interrupt you, but I have been putting this out there in the universe that I need to find an amazing race partner. Do you know that show, The Amazing Race?
Totally do that with you. We would crush it. I'm not even kidding you.
Exactly.
Call me later.
I am too, because that's my weakness is those puzzles.
I'm serious. And I think we could come up with a mad, wicked application video. They will totally take us.
For sure.
Oh my God. Okay. All right. This is okay. All right. Well, folks, you heard it here. I'm going to be 61, and that might be my 61st birthday present, is to apply for The Amazing Race with Dr. Chan. That would be amazing.
I think we'd crush it.
So you're jobbed your way through veterinary school. Now you're 29 and you have a DVM?
Yeah. Yep. So DVM. So, but I always knew I wanted to be an internist. So I applied for a rotating internship after veterinary school. As a veterinarian, and I was grateful to get my first choice. So I matched at Cornell. So I did a small animal rotating internship at Cornell, which is the typical thing you would do if you want formal postgraduate didactic training as a veterinarian. So you can kind of go into general practice or you can do further training. So I did an internship. And then at the time, my husband had decided to go back to school for a physics PhD. He got in everywhere that I applied for an internship except Cornell. So he chose the Ohio State because they have one of the best public school PhD graduate programs in physics. And we bought a house in Columbus. So we kind of shared cat custody. I had two, he had two. And we, for a year, we were 7 hours apart. And then I only applied for a residency in internal medicine to The Ohio State, figuring we'll let fate decide, because I'm going to move, you know, he's still there. I'm either going to do a residency or not. And I was very grateful to get selected for that spot. So I moved back to the house I already own, and I did my residency in Columbus.
Did you have any kids then at this point?
Well, yes. Yes. We had Chloe, Sunny, Bean, and Orbit Karens. Four cats. No non-furry human children. Yeah.
So you finished your residency in record time, probably.
Well, 3 years. You have to do 3 years. But and then I also did a concurrent master's degree in looking at cats that have a virus called feline immunodeficiency virus, and looking at different arms in the innate immune system that may confer a protection against exposure to an infection with FIV.
One of the things that I would imagine would be great about working with you as a referring doctor of veterinary medicine is you have, because I've watched you do this on stage too, you have a gift of basically being able to say, no, silly, the answer is right here in front of you. Do what the answer is without making RDBMs feel stupid.
Yeah, I feel like I've always had that people thing. And, you know, both my mom and my dad were teachers, and there's a lot of, in different disciplines, there's a lot of educators in the family. And so communicating to people and explaining things, and as I try to connect with them to kind of normalize and humanize, it's my favorite thing to do. I'm actually working right now on my bucket list is, you know, I just said academic achievements, but jokes aside, it's not for the point of the degree, but it's for the point of gaining more skills so that I can be more effective in doing what I love. And I think that's, Sean, and to circle back to what you asked me, that's kind of how I go about any sort of continuing education that I'm doing with my GP colleagues, whether I'm at an external conference or doing something on another platform or forum. It's just an extension of the same thing. It's like leaning in and saying, y'all, I remember what this topic was like in vet school. You have like 1 hour on it. Let's just unpack it and make it clinically relevant. Like, there should be no guilt or shame in that conversation.
Tell us about your position now. And how that seems like a lovely fit, and what you're doing currently professionally. Like, what's your jam at Thrive, and what are you hoping to accomplish there?
So I've been with Thrive about 6.5 years, and I've had many, many different roles related to the company growing quickly and the need to provide additional support to our hospitals. So I had an operational role supporting many, many different hospitals with the cultural, medical, and financial success, that three-legged stool to support those teams. But for the last 4 years, I've been in my current role, which I created with our leadership team because it didn't exist before. So it was like, let's fill a need with this position. So VP of Medical Excellence and Education. So basically what that means is that I'm accountable to create and then sustain programs, processes, and resources to support all of our medical team members, so doctors, techs, assistants, with anything they would need to thrive, pun intended, in their journey. So I talk about like that piece of sushi off the menu. What are you in the mood for now? And then as you grow, what do you want in the future, right? It's always going to change. So specifically, the types of things that would fall within my center of excellence would be all of our mentorship programs, all of our medical initiatives, our training programs, our formal postgraduate educational programs, so our internships and our residencies and our externships, things surrounding how to keep our people safe with important team and patient safety topics that are medical, like anesthesia, radiation safety, controlled substances. And then last but not least, clinical research that our hospitals are involved in, and our specialty director board. So supporting a national director, board certified specialist director of each lane, whose job it is to shepherd and support those doctors in that lane, as well as to pull their knowledge through across the business so we don't silo. So by way of example, our dentistry director and his team creating a curriculum on demand in our learning system, as well as a wet lab that we travel to hospitals to empower technicians and doctors in primary care to improve medical outcomes for pets surrounding dentistry through the training we provide. So unsiloing those different verticals or lanes of practice. So I I love it. I'm so grateful for the opportunity that that the Thrive leadership team has given me and the support that I receive to continue to constantly augment what I'm building and what my team and I are creating for the people of Thrive. It's just, I love it.
You are one of the most unique individuals I know. I am a very unique individual in a corporate and a business environment. What I know about Thrive for sure is that it embraces uniqueness and weirdos and competence and people that want to make a difference. So how is this translating into day-to-day achievements at a street level, if you will?
Yeah. So, okay. So there's a couple things. So can I take first, because I get really excited to talk about it. You know, you mentioned like the profession, the challenges, the sky is falling. I'm incredibly excited by the opportunities that our profession has right now. Like, I feel like our profession is at a natural point in its life cycle. You know, it's kind of like when I look at my children, I don't notice their growth every day, but I'll look at Archie and say, oh my God, he just grew like 6 inches. Like, it's stair steps, right? And I feel like we are at a natural intersection or a crossroads in our profession where we are at one of those stair steps in terms of evolution. You know, a lot of things have changed, like life, you know, the universe, right? Like, you know, the only thing that's constant is change, right? And so at the macro, things are different. They're different, you know, with, you know, people, humans, in terms of the customer service that they want and the concierge experience they want and, you know, folks wanting to advocate for their own health and their pet's health. Now, when you look at the macro of some, like kind of buyer's market, seller's market for a number of folks that are then applying to, say, positions to work as doctors at hospitals, I think the profession is uniformly experiencing that it's a little bit of a buyer's market, you know, meaning that there might be a zillion openings in the hospitals and that, you know, the candidate kind of can pick and choose because they'll have 10 offers in front of them.
You know, I was doing a panel at Fetch on the future of veterinary medicine. And I did want to touch on this in your when or what is the, because you are, if anybody's a veterinarian, you're a veterinarian. And the perception out there in the zeitgeist with nurses is that in general, veterinarians might be against the stratification of nurses' skills, like a physician's assistant. Where a nurse can not only, so that we see nurses making real livings and blah, blah, blah. What, you know what I'm talking about. So what is that? Is there any room in the veterinary model for what's going on in the human model? Or is that not even something we should aspire to? You know what? How can we use our nurses more and pay them more?
Yeah. I think when you look at the AVMA data, when they put out State of the Union data, it's objective data. A few years ago, 3 years ago, I think it was, the AVMA State of the Union data literally said that 1 in 2 non-credentialed technicians and 1 in 3 credentialed technicians have as part of their daily job description answering the telephone in the hospital. And so I think we would all agree, we do not utilize our technicians to the maximum of their skill set and the max to which the relevant state licensure will allow. We all know that state by state,
right,
it's different.
Right, right.
And so I think that the challenge for us that we need to embrace is to fix that, is we need to empower our technicians universally. We need to be utilizing those amazing technicians to the maximum of their skill set and what the relevant state licensure allows in a team-based healthcare model, as we continue to fill the and grow them and invest in them to continue to grow their skills so they can progress, right? Be an even more impactful member of that team. Having our technicians practice to the maximum of their skill set and the max to what the relevant state licensure allows and continue to grow and invest in those technicians. What are you worried about? And I don't mean that sarcastically. I am seeking to understand. In those conversations, I actually have found in a delightful way that we are not actually arguing or misaligned, but we haven't actually had bold conversations. So that I believe we need to just continue to humanistically have those conversations if it takes hospital by hospital by hospital by hospital.
Because Kelly, I think we've got to start there, like in a state. And I'm passionate about this because, you know, if you talk to anybody at any level in veterinary medicine and HR, the single biggest problem is I can't find people. In particular, I can't find doctors. And so, you know, you just spoke to the fact it is what it is, but there is something we can do right now that we don't have to wait for 5 years. What if nurses took the place of, you know, three nurses took the place of every one doctor, you know, and or maybe that's too high, but I'm just saying in terms of it would secure people for a lifetime in veterinary medicine that are looking for that investment already, and it would fill a hole that the clients desperately want. We already have a model there. So like, what's missing, you know?
When you ask most veterinarians what support for them looks like, or what would help you? Like, what does success for you look like? A lot of them, you know, comment on things that will help me with my time efficiency. So I can focus on the things that only I can do as the veterinarian. And when you look at how you provide them with that, it does involve leveraging every single person on the team. So you have a full puzzle with minimal gaps and redundancies. And so I think it's just, I'm the queen of crazy analogies. There is enough pie for everybody here. There's enough cake for everybody to eat cake. And, you know, right, to quote a wise sage, rising tides lift all boats.
How do you sit down instead of doing pathway planning? You've already done that. Basically making your milestones, your goals, all about employee development and sitting down and come. And so taking 3 to 6 hours out of a weekend to really spend an hour on that lead nurse, and how am I going to get her to making $80,000 a year? And, yeah. And how am I going to fill this gap?
Yeah. Because our doctors say it, you know, we're on the phone, we do all our consulting calls, and they see the opportunity. You know, we talk almost daily with practices that see their compensation expenses too high. We look at their staff to doctor ratios, and they have enough people, right, to do the work, but then they're not optimizing them enough, right? It's costing them a lot. They're not doing the right work. And so we don't have equal skill sets for everybody in the same position. We have these conversations about training and how can we really optimize the team. And I think that there's a couple of big hurdles, at least from my experience in having some of these conversations. It's one, ultimately getting to a place where some doctors really do trust their teams, which really does boil down to the second thing, which is training. And the one thing that nobody ever has enough time for, right? And it's like they can see a future where, you know, fill in the blank, this person has this skill, this can help me move X times faster and yada, yada, yada. I think that where they get stuck is the investment requires, yeah, whether that just be time, energy, actual physical training. And then they sort of get stuck in this hamster wheel, exactly, of like, want this, don't know how, exactly. And they just start spinning the wheels.
I think if when you look at all of the conversations that are happening on that nurse practitioner mid-level, it feels to me that everyone has amazing intentions. And it feels to me like we're off to the side and it's a MacGuffin that's distracting from I don't know what problem it would solve. I'm not anti or pro mid-level nurse practitioner, but I don't know what problem it solves if we think about why. Like when you think about problem solving, like when you say, why is this happening now? Why is that happening now? Why is that happening? When you get to the root why will still exist with a mid-level practitioner, because the root why is the reticence of everyone to embrace leveraging each technician to the max of their skill set and the max of what the relevant state licensure will allow. I think there's a ton of work that needs to be done first there before we create a new position. It's simply empowering, you know, even a veterinary assistant of are they being maximally leveraged to exactly what there's. And then the technician that already exists, because I believe if we actually solve for that, then it, you know, again, would we immediately need a mid-level practitioner that could do more advanced things?
You're right. It's more the concept and that whole aha thing of the 220 tech skills, et cetera. So if you'd be willing to work with us, I think we wanted to flush that out and develop that kind of program you've already done pathway planning. Now you want something new from VGP where the leadership team gets spent. What would be worth spending, you know, $5,000 for a weekend as a leadership team is come up with that. So that would be great. So I guess in wrapping this up, Kelly, Where do you see your career taking you, like, in the next 5 years? What's besides the plan, like, what do you feel like, not just Thrive, but veterinary medicine is going? Where do you think we're headed?
Where is veterinary medicine headed?
And you in veterinary medicine.
And me. I think, you know, in all the conversations that I've had with different groups of folks, you know, whether it's AVMA, kind of House of Delegates, I'm not a delegate, but, like, you know, I've talked to the delegates, I've been in one of those meetings. You know, whether I'm in a National Academy of Practice meeting where there's physicians and pharmacists and veterinarians and we're ideating, when I talk to folks in the veterinary profession, I think veterinary medical education is at a real fork in the road in a wonderful, positive way. When we look at all of the new veterinary schools, I think we have 30 or 32 right now, and probably in you know, 7 or 8 years, we're going to have 40. Mm-hmm. And all of the distributive model schools that will rely on private practice for the fourth year clinical year rotations. I think that competency development and assessment for both students and educators is really in an ramping up evolutionarily. I think we're going to see a lot of utilization of technology. I just think we are at a place in our life cycle where that the human physician training space was in probably about 20, 30 years ago. And I think it's a really exciting time to embrace that, because you have to continue to evolve to continue to grow. You know, I want to be at the center of the Tootsie Pop, to be able to continue to be at the table, not only in the ideations, but in the strategic conversations that lead to execution strategies, right? In a way that I can have the most impact on scale for the people in this profession. Again, to make this profession as sustainable as possible for the people that are called to it. They're called to it. Like, we kind of just come out and we're like of the womb and we're like, I am called to this. It is our passion-driven purpose.
Yeah, you're like therapists and pastors and preachers. Yes. And you're like, you know, like, you're called. Yeah.
So how can we decrease the barrier to entry and increase the sustainability in a way that is happy and fulfilling for people, so that there doesn't need to be as much dysfunction and suffering as you're concurrently doing the thing you love? So, you know, I want to be involved. I want to continue to be given a seat at the table for as long as it is that my go switch is on. Because when it's on, I'm going to bring 200% to it.
That, folks, is Dr. Kelly Cairns. And that's exactly why we have her on the show, because I, like, just think about the last 5 minutes of what she said. You're one of the few people that I think might actually surpass my capacity to on the fly talk and, like, pull words out. I can see you pulling words out of your brain to express what you want to express. And it's only because you have this monster vocabulary and complete recall of, like, you know how you want to make an impact. I'm like, that must be how I look when I'm talking, except for I don't understand all of those words.
Thank you so much, you guys. I so appreciate the opportunity and everything you guys are doing.
We're lucky to have you be our advocate too.
Thank you for doing this with us.